It is Thursday, July 16th. We have a lot of ground to cover this morning, starting with the state of the Department of Justice. We are also tracking a pivot in how the tech industry handles its most dangerous tools. Let's get into it. We are starting today with a confirmation hearing for Todd Blanche, the nominee for Deputy Attorney General. Blanche previously served as President Trump's personal defense attorney. This creates a direct conflict between the executive agenda and the department's traditional role as an independent legal authority. With a Republican majority in the Senate, the nomination hinges on whether Blanche can convince skeptics in his own party that he will prioritize the public interest over his history of client advocacy. The tension is structural. If the Deputy Attorney General acts as an extension of the president's legal team, the department loses its appearance of impartiality. This is being highlighted by high-visibility controversies, including the handling of the Jeffrey Epstein files and a previous settlement regarding the president's tax returns. While Blanche has distanced himself from the proposed anti-weaponization fund and stated he disagrees with blanket pardons for January 6 rioters, the underlying legal frameworks, including immunity provisions for the president's family and businesses, remain heavily contested. The Senate's handling of this nomination sets a new institutional precedent. If they confirm a nominee who served as the president's personal counsel, it signals to future administrations that the firewall between the White House and federal prosecutions is effectively gone. The skepticism from Republican senators, including John Cornyn, shows that the narrow majority gives individual lawmakers significant leverage to demand policy concessions. The involvement of Epstein survivors in the process only adds to the pressure, as the public watches to see if the department's handling of sensitive files will be transparent or politically motivated. In Maine, Democratic Senate candidate Graham Plattees, pronounced Plattees, has withdrawn from his race following allegations of sexual assault. This collapse reveals a deep gap between national political narratives and local voter priorities. Outside observers often dismissed Plattees as a performative rejection of establishment politics. However, his supporters, particularly women, backed him because they were looking for a progressive, forward-looking vision that broke from party tradition. National analysts tended to fixate on his working-class background as a calculated persona. Maine voters, meanwhile, viewed his background as normal and his focus on issues like trans rights as a breath of fresh air. The Maine Democratic Party is now using a nominating convention to replace him, but they face a difficult task. They are trying to defeat incumbent Susan Collins, but they have no candidate who can match the rhetorical style that attracted voters to Plattees in the first place. This event also highlights the failure of predictive journalism. By focusing on polling and percentage forecasting, instead of actual descriptive reporting, political media has left voters feeling like passive observers of a broken process. The demand for a non-traditional, hopeful political vision in Maine remains strong, but the party is now struggling to offer that vision without the liability of the messenger who first articulated it. On the technology front, reports are circulating that Apple is considering legal action against OpenAI. The speculation centers on claims that OpenAI stole trade secrets and hired away key staff to build a competing hardware device. This is a defensive move intended to protect Apple's platform dominance by stalling OpenAI's hardware plans before they hit the mass market. The conflict here is a classic innovator's dilemma. Apple controls the primary interface for consumer technology through the iPhone and the App Store. This allows them to collect a 15-30% commission on third-party services like ChatGPT. By building an AI-native device, OpenAI is trying to bypass Apple's ecosystem to control its own distribution. If OpenAI succeeds, they move from being a tenant on Apple's platform to a direct competitor. Apple's legal strategy is to slow down OpenAI's development cycle. by alleging that OpenAI's hardware division relies on stolen intellectual property, Apple triggers a long discovery process. This forces OpenAI to burn time and money on legal defense and audits, while also discouraging future recruitment of former Apple employees. If Apple wins an injunction, it could force OpenAI to redesign its products, potentially delaying them by years. Apple is trying to avoid repeating the mistake they made with Google and Android, where they waited until the competitor had already reached mass adoption. The next 20 years of computing will likely shift from app-based interactions to agent-based, voice-driven AI, and both companies know this potential lawsuit is essentially a fight to control the next computing paradigm. There is a broader, systemic shift happening in American politics. Progressive activists and leaders are moving away from traditional polite discourse in favor of direct confrontation and public ridicule. This is a strategic response to the realization that opponents have weaponized norms of civility to suppress dissent. They are using tactics like buying opponent-branded web domains and using satire to undermine political figures. This bypasses traditional media gatekeepers and engages audiences who feel alienated by jargon-heavy discourse. However, there is a significant risk of alienating moderate voters if this strategy comes across as purely vitriolic. The institutional consequences are even more severe. We are seeing a concerted effort to repurpose government machinery for political retribution, from the nomination of hyperpartisan figures to the targeted investigation of civil rights organizations. When a presidential administration uses prosecution as a tool of political suppression, it creates a dangerous precedent. It shifts the Department of Justice from a shield for public protection to a sword for political enforcement. This forces civil society organizations into a defensive posture where they must divert resources from their core missions just to survive. The ultimate takeaway is that the durability of democratic institutions is no longer a passive expectation. It is an active requirement. The effectiveness of any political movement today depends on its ability to combine transparent, results-oriented governance with a willingness to challenge the machinery that thrives on fear and misinformation. We are seeing a cycle of civic exhaustion and cynicism, where voters perceive the system as a closed loop of partisan warfare. If leaders cannot bridge this gap by validating systemic frustrations while providing a clear, actionable path for reform, the cycle of disengagement will only intensify. Speaking of things that need better oversight, the AI industry is finally admitting that letting software run wild might have been a mistake. The industry is shifting its focus. We are moving away from the Wild West era of autonomous AI agents toward what engineers are calling harness-led systems. Last year, the novelty was letting agents run loose. Now, the priority is building the guardrails and feedback loops that let humans keep their hands on the wheel. Think of it less like a magic button and more like a software factory. Agents are being embedded into specific workflows with strict permissions and quality gates. It is a necessary pivot. Unchecked autonomy has been leading to ballooning costs and some uncomfortable security gaps. The goal now is to treat AI as a reasoning partner rather than a replacement. This shift is creating a new division of labor. You have the inner loop, where agents do the heavy lifting, and the outer loop, where human engineers set the constraints and feedback. It forces a move toward what the industry is calling skill encapsulation. Instead of just hoping the model guesses the right way to do something, engineers are now encoding institutional knowledge and business best practices into reusable skills. It is fundamentally changing how knowledge work gets managed. The companies that learn to use AI to augment their existing teams are going to outperform the ones trying to replace them with autonomous bots. Meanwhile, OpenAI has moved into the mass market agent space. The company has integrated new agentic features into its existing platform, and the company reports significant user growth over the last 48 hours. This isn't just a chatbot anymore. The platform is designed to interact directly with your desktop, files, and browsers. It works as a persistent agent that can run tasks around the clock, manage subagents, and handle complex workflows like data scraping or automated communications. You aren't just prompting a bot, you are managing a digital workforce. Shifts the user from a collaborator to a manager. You are now expected to define Agent MD files, essentially governing documents that set the goals for your digital team. There are some growing pains, though. Right now, the experience is fragmented across web, desktop, and mobile. If you don't keep an eye on your synchronization, you end up doing redundant work or giving your agents misaligned instructions. It is a powerful tool, but it demands a different kind of operational discipline. Then there is the question of whether any of this is actually sustainable. A growing argument suggests the current multi-billion dollar investment cycle in large language models is a bubble waiting to pop. The industry is spending massive amounts on GPUs and data centers, yet there is no clear business model to recover those costs. These models are quickly becoming commodities. Open-source versions are already matching the performance of proprietary ones. If compute costs keep dropping, the data centers built today will lose a massive chunk of their value in less than a decade. The long-term play, according to this view, is not in the cloud, but in local hardware. The real bottleneck to human-level AI isn't software, it is the physical world. Our robotics hardware, specifically things like artificial hands, is nowhere near as advanced as our software. Until that changes, AI stays trapped in digital environments. But as compute costs collapse, intelligence will eventually move from centralized servers to your own private devices. It is the evolution of the telecommunications industry all over again. We started with expensive, exclusive tech and ended up with pocket-sized, ubiquitous tools. Finally, we have to talk about the security of these systems. AI development is moving from deterministic code, where instructions dictate behavior, to probabilistic models. In these systems, the data plane and the control plane are essentially the same thing. That means the data you use to train or prompt the model directly dictates how it executes. It creates a new class of vulnerability. You can inject malware into training sets that stays dormant until it is triggered. Traditional security perimeters just don't work here. You can sign your code to prove where it came from, but that doesn't prove the behavior inside is safe. The most dangerous threats aren't system crashes. They are subtle influence campaigns. A nation-state actor could poison a model used for code generation, causing microscopic errors across thousands of organizations simultaneously. It is a slow-burn attack that looks like a minor hallucination until it is too late. The industry is realizing that AI models are essentially unverified components. If you are going to use them, you have to treat them like Trojan horses and build your security around that assumption. That kind of calculated risk-taking in tech isn't so different from what we are seeing in the world of high-stakes horse racing. High-stakes horse racing tournaments are shifting away from picking the most likely winner. The goal is now focused on optimizing price, leverage, and bankroll management. This approach treats handicapping as a systems-based exercise rather than a series of individual bets. Winning in these tournaments requires a move away from betting on favorites. Favorites are often overbet, which leads to narrow, insufficient returns that cannot overcome the house cut. Instead, the strategy demands identifying inflection points. These include specific changes like a horse moving from a dirt track to turf, or a horse being entered at a higher class level than it has previously run. By betting against the favorites in these deep fields, you accept a lower win probability in exchange for higher payouts. This is what the experts call taking a stand. When this strategy works, it allows for a leaner, more aggressive ticket structure that can lead to large tournament scores. The technical requirements for this are, frankly, exhausting. Casual bettors often miss the impact of track bias or fail to interpret beaten claiming conditions correctly. You have to look past a horse's past performances and reputation. You must verify that a horse's historical speed and form actually align with the specific conditions of the current race. Here's the thing. This is essentially turning a sport that markets itself on romance and tradition into a cold, math-heavy grind. If you are just going to the track to root for the horse with the prettiest name, you are going to get slaughtered. That's not news, but the shift in tournament play makes it official. The industry is essentially admitting that if you aren't doing the homework on pace projectors and class levels, you are just providing the liquidity for the people who are. It's a brutal way to look at a race. You're no longer looking for the fastest animal. You're looking for the structural inefficiency in the betting pool. It's the difference between being a fan and being a predator, which, honestly, sounds like a hell of a way to spend a Saturday afternoon. But if the goal is to actually win a tournament, the conventional wisdom is officially dead. You either evolve to match the volatility of the field, or you just keep funding the payouts for everyone else. But while gamblers are busy crunching numbers to find an edge, the people running the show in Dallas are betting on infrastructure to secure their future. The Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex successfully hosted a major soccer event at AT&T Stadium. The event is being treated as a proof of concept for the region to serve as a permanent hub for global tournaments. Organizers managed the logistics and extreme heat without incident, setting a benchmark for future host cities. Fox Sports is currently testing a strategy of cross-promoting its soccer coverage with the Major League Baseball All-Star Game. The network is incorporating live, in-game audio from players, like pitcher-catcher conversations, into the broadcast to drive engagement. It is a pivot toward making the viewing experience more analytical and entertainment-focused. The trade-off, however, is that this focus on access might eventually undermine the competitive intensity of the games. Meanwhile, a labor standoff is brewing in Major League Baseball. Commissioner Rob Manfred and MLBPA leader Bruce Mayer are in a public debate over a potential salary cap. Manfred characterizes it as a necessity for fairness, while Mayer labels it a subsidy for mediocrity. The two sides have until December 1st, when the collective bargaining agreement expires, to reach a deal. If they stay deadlocked, it could stall on-field innovations and create significant instability for the league. In the streaming world, the Bundesliga has moved its U.S. broadcast rights to a new digital platform. This is a departure from traditional sports networks like ESPN. By partnering with a platform focused on digital distribution, the German league is betting that it can build new viewing habits within a broader entertainment ecosystem. It's a sign that smaller sports properties are looking for new ways to capture attention outside of the established sports media bubble. Soccer analytics, meanwhile, has moved into a phase of high-frequency modeling. Teams are using skeletal body pose data to quantify defensive lane closure and movement threats, treating the sport as a series of computational problems. Analysts now act as translators, turning complex neural network outputs into video clips for coaches. It is effectively turning the sport into an exercise in risk mitigation. The potential downside here is a convergence effect, where teams optimize for mathematically sound tactics that end up being boring to watch. Finally, in the NFL, the Tennessee Titans are attempting a major roster overhaul for the 2026 season. Under new head coach Robert Saleh and offensive coordinator Brian Daboll, the team is prioritizing a quarterback-centric offense around Cam Ward. The strategy relies on Ward making a significant leap in his second year, while the team devalues the offensive line to stack skilled players. It is a high-risk gamble. The team has seen consistent leadership struggles, and Saleh must prove he can manage head coaching duties while delegating play calling. Betting markets are skeptical, setting the Titans' win total at 6.5 and offering long-shot odds. It is a classic ceiling versus floor situation. If the offense clicks, they are dangerous. But if the lack of protection leads to sacks and turnovers, the organization is looking at a rapid collapse. Infrastructure is one thing, but the media business is struggling to find any footing at all as the old revenue models continue to crater. The British media landscape is hitting a wall. The BBC, pronounced BBC, has 2 million fewer license fee payers than it did 5 years ago. That revenue drop is forcing the corporation to cut programs, which leaves a vacuum for commercial outlets like LBC, pronounced LBC, to fill. The problem here is scale. LBC doesn't have the international resources the BBC does, so the quality of reporting is effectively being hollowed out. It's not just about what stays on the air, though. The BBC is now trying to claw back intellectual property rights from independent producers to bolster its own balance sheet. This is a zero-sum game that threatens to break the wider UK television export market. If independent producers lose their rights, they can't reinvest in new projects. And if they can't innovate, the BBC loses the very pipeline of high-quality content it needs to survive. It's a miserable cycle. The political environment is making it worse. The Trump administration has used grand jury subpoenas to target journalists at the asterisk New York Times over reporting on classified material. This isn't just standard friction between the press and the state. It is a strategy of coercive control. When the cost of doing investigative journalism includes massive legal fees and the threat of jail time, the ability to hold power to account starts to vanish. What we're left with is a shrinking, more partisan public square. When public service media has to focus on simple survival and commercial media pivots to whatever is viral or controversial, the room for actual, nuanced analysis disappears. Moving over to the states, we've got a massive antitrust fight brewing. California Attorney General Rob Bonta is suing to block the Paramount Skydance Warner Bros. Discovery merger. But here is the thing. The lawsuit seems to be fighting a war that ended a decade ago. Bonta's case relies on traditional metrics like cable pricing and theatrical distribution. The court will almost certainly look at that and note that it ignores the real competition, which is TikTok, YouTube, and Netflix. If the court decides the regulators are looking at the wrong map, the merger will likely sail through. This anxiety is bleeding into the newsroom at CBS. 60 Minutes is currently undergoing a leadership transition under Nick Bilton. The show has seen a string of high-profile departures, and there is a lot of industry chatter about whether the program can maintain its editorial standards while pivoting to compete with tech platforms rather than traditional networks. If asterisk 60 Minutes falters, it'll be used as the ultimate proof that the era of the traditional news gatekeeper is over. It's a messy situation for CBS, but honestly, it's just a symptom of a larger shift. Legacy brands are losing their leverage in a digital-first economy. Trying to win these battles through antitrust litigation feels like trying to stop the tide with a rake. Finally, let's look at the financial side of this grind. There is ongoing market speculation regarding a potential acquisition of PayPal, though no verified bid of $53 billion has been confirmed. The company has seen significant shifts in valuation over the last 3 years, and analysts are closely watching for any signs of a consolidation play. Meanwhile, other companies are just trying to keep the lights on. Verizon is planning another round of layoffs. They want to cut $5 billion in operating costs by 2026. They've already cut 13,000 jobs last November and more this past May. When a company cuts that deep, that often, they aren't just pruning fat. They're losing the institutional knowledge they need to actually build things. Then there's the automotive sector. Lucid Group, pronounced Lucid, had to publicly deny reports that it was filing for bankruptcy. They did confirm they are working with the consulting firm Alix Partners, pronounced Alix Partners. Now, for those who haven't spent time in corporate boardrooms, bringing in consultants like that is usually the first step toward a major restructuring or a forced sale. The stock dropped 16% on the news before they issued the denial. Even if they avoid a bankruptcy filing, the road ahead looks like a long, painful downsizing. The market is volatile right now, and the divide is clear. You have companies trying to consolidate power to gain an edge, and you have legacy firms like Verizon and Lucid just trying to survive the quarter. It's a shitty environment for anyone betting on long-term stability. The era of easy, speculative growth is dead. We are deep in the era of structural discipline, which is just a polite way of saying everyone is cutting everything to hit a margin target. If you are feeling the pressure of that same cutthroat environment, you are not alone, though the advice for your personal health is surprisingly similar. The latest reports on high-performance living suggest we stop treating health as a series of crises to manage and start treating it like a system-level engineering challenge. Regenerative tech, think gene editing and AI-driven diagnostics, is moving from experimental to accessible. The argument here is that relying on conventional care is a liability. If you can use AI imaging to predict a heart attack 5 years out, you move from expensive, reactive surgery to simple, regenerative maintenance. It's a shift from waiting for the system to collapse to actively managing your own biology. The same logic applies to your headspace. Thoughts aren't just happening to you, they're being primed by your environment. If you're doom scrolling, you're literally wiring your brain for anxiety. The fix is conscious priming, things like cold exposure or intentional gratitude to bypass emotional reactivity. And look, I get it. This sounds like standard self-help fluff, but the core point is that comfort is the enemy of growth. If your success isn't tied to a mission that's bigger than your paycheck, you're going to hit a wall of existential boredom every single time. When the work actually gets hard, the strategy is to shrink your scope. Don't look at the massive, monolithic project waiting for you. Narrow your focus to the single, immediate, physical task in front of you. It's a way to shield your brain from overload. By accepting discomfort as a constant rather than fighting it, you stop burning energy on resistance. It turns a long, grueling endurance test into a series of short, binary objectives. Basically, if your current systems aren't producing results, don't try to patch them. Disruption isn't a tragedy, it's a tool. Tear the old routine down, reverse engineer your goals, and build something that actually forces you to change. It's shitty in the short term, but it's the only way to avoid long-term stagnation. Finally, if you are looking for where the smart money is hiding, while the rest of the market loses its mind, here is what you need to know. A few other things worth knowing today. Proton is using a foundation-controlled corporate structure to keep itself away from the reach of venture capital vultures. It is a smart way to ensure they prioritize user privacy over, you know, the usual extractive growth that ruins every other tech company. Scott Galloway is pointing out that modern authoritarianism is a slow burn. It does not happen with a dramatic coup, but by hollowing out institutions from the inside until there is nothing left to fight back with. It is the kind of quiet rot that is easy to ignore until the lights go out. Private credit firms are currently trying to hide declining loan quality by stripping away basic borrower protections. When they cannot raise interest rates, they just weaken the rules, which is a hell of a way to build a financial house of cards in the software sector. Finally, the yield curve is still screaming that the economy is not as healthy as the headlines suggest. A flat curve at these rates shows that investors are terrified of risk and are fleeing for safety, which is rarely a sign of a booming, prosperous future. That is the state of things for July 16th. I will be back tomorrow to see if any of these systems actually hold up. Stay sharp.